I was struck by the gentleman's reference. The guys doing, was it the experiment at Chernobyl, were not tipped off by the brass to certain features of the construction or some such of the plant. Correct. And I'm curious as to, A, if he has a guess as to how that happened, and B, to what extent were any lessons learned? Did any heads roll? What was the upshot?
In my personal opinion, I think it was more a political and bureaucratic decision to not disseminate that information. I mean, scientifically, mathematically, things are pretty easy, right? 2 + 2 = 4. If we look at the configuration of the core and you say, well, let's imagine there's a steam pocket that's preventing water from cooling a portion of the core, what kind of effect is that going to have? There had been incidents in history where they had other RBMK reactors of the same design, and they had noticed that under some circumstances that there would be a slight power surge when they would try and scram the reactor, insert the control rods. But generally, the other conditions inside the reactor did not prevent the control rods from inserting. At Chernobyl, the instances that you had the pressure inside the reactor increasing 15 atmospheres per second. You had the destruction of the fuel channels, which is, you know, the control rods are sliding in between these fuel channels where the fuel assemblies are. As those collapse and fall apart, it prevents them from getting pushed in. So the problem had been identified at other plants. It had never been analyzed, and no lessons learned had been taken by the industry before that. But it was known that there was a history of problems with power surges under certain conditions when you were trying to shut these reactors
down. So would you say that the brass didn't do their homework when they withheld this information? Or what were the motives?
I think there's issues, there's strengths and weaknesses to every reactor design. And each of them has had its own torrid history of having those strengths and weaknesses come out or not come out until after an accident. And I think that at Chernobyl, it was one of these conditions where it didn't seem like an imminent concern to them before. Okay, it's just a little power surge. I mean, as long as the control rods go in, it's just a bumpy landing. I don't think that they wanted to consider what could happen if the control rods couldn't fully insert and all that they did was provide this surge. Does that make sense?
Well, okay, I don't have the expertise. I'm trying to understand the human aspect of this. But go ahead.
Question. I was wondering I know that Chernobyl is in Ukraine, but it used to be in the Soviet Union. So I was wondering who's paying for the cleanup at this point? And also, are the workers coming from like the local areas, or are they bringing workers from Russia or from other, you know, countries, or and sort of just in general about the politics of like managing this disaster around that building?
The funding of the continuation of remediation and deconstruction activities is a big concern. The international funding at the moment is focused on the construction of the new confinement structure. When that moves in place, which they are expecting sometime next year. If I had to guess, I would probably say 2018, 2019, they'll finally put it in place. There's no incentive for them to put it in place because once they do, the international funds dry out. This power plant does not produce power. There is no source of income for them aside from the assistance that they're getting from their government and the international community. There is concern by the workers that after the new confinement structure moves in place, the international community will cease to support them in terms of manpower, engineers, obviously funding, and I share that concern. I definitely share that concern. So I think that there's still a lot of questions that need to be answered. To be honest, the Ukrainian economy cannot solely support the decommissioning and those activities. If you look at the inflation of the hryvnia, the Ukrainian currency, since 2010, it's a fraction, like a quarter of what it was just a few years ago. When the Soviet Union was dissolved, Ukraine was kind of given the short end of a stick. You know, they had a lot of former great farmland, but they also had this terrible association with Chernobyl that came along with it. There wasn't a lot of industry power that they had, and even right now they aren't producing a lot. So there is some concern about that, I think, as far as where is this future funding going to go. I think it's important that the international community understands that we're going to be required to financially support this cleanup program until your grandkids have grandkids or farther on after that.
So the money's coming from a lot of different sources internationally?
Correct. Right now, for the construction of the new confinement structure, the workers, to touch on that part of your question, right now for the construction of the new confinement structure, there is a lot of international workers. In fact, one of the crane operators for the turbine building where they're repairing that roof has bounced back and forth between Fukushima Daiichi and Chernobyl for the last 5 years, operating cranes at both of those sites. There's a lot of workers from France. Currently, right now, when we were there in September, there were no workers from Russia at the time because of the difficult relationship between those two countries. When the conflict broke out, the Russian workers were pulled back. So there are some Americans, there are some Europeans, there's the majority of the people that are doing activities not related to the construction are locals. And like I said, it's easier for them to get a job if they can find someone who they know, who's a family member, to help refer them and get them to the right areas. So mostly, like my friend Anton there, his father and his mother was in Pripyat at the time of the accident. His father later was a security guard at Chernobyl, and he finally got his job, and he works in the relations department.
Okay, this is wise enough to provide the funding for you and about your organization itself.
My company, we provided the funding for this. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, to be honest, and it was something that I would not have gone as a tourist. There's no point. I would not go to Japan right now because the accident is still unfolding. I felt comfortable going on this program because it was an opportunity hosted by the nuclear power plant. We got to take our own equipment. We got to take our own cameras. Really, the only rule was don't take a picture of the security fence. And to be honest, I didn't care about the security fences anywhere. I was more concerned what was going on inside of them. So when we looked at it, it was a no-brainer decision. The personal experiences, the opportunities to work hand-in-hand with the workers, to be trained. I got this great little certificate from Chernobyl Nuclear Power Plant that says that we're trained in environmental radiation response to industrial accidents. There was no real question about it. It was whether or not we would be allowed to go. We have to be vetted. Yeah, it's a private company. And our focus is more just on the monitoring of radioactive materials as they move through the environment. So we get hired, we get brought out. Like, have you heard of Westlake Landfill down in St. Louis? It's a landfill that's on fire that has a bunch of nuclear waste from the Manhattan Project in it. And I've been working down there for the last almost 4 years now. So we visit a lot of sites. The opportunity to visit Chernobyl and then have a first-person experience, be able to take that experience back to these other sites, it was invaluable.
Question on the spent fuels at Chernobyl. You said you showed pictures of where they were in the facility, and my understanding is that they have to be kept cool.
Yes.
As in Fukushima, they melted down. Did they melt down after the accident when everyone disappeared?
The fate of the Unit 4 spent fuel is a little up in the air. We know a little bit, but we can't access all of the areas. We're really only able to access about 60% of the areas inside of the sarcophagus. So the ones from the other reactors was recovered, and you're correct. For the first few years, it needs to be kept underwater. That's the ISF-1, the first building that I showed. Right, so it's pools. They're stored there. The issue that they're having right now, the new facility that they're constructing, the RBMK fuel assembly is very long. It's square, and it's in two sections. There's an upper section and a lower section, and they're separated by a very thin margin, and the same rod holds these two sections together. So what they're in the process of doing is they're building a new facility, so when the assemblies have cooled down enough, they can take them out. There'll be a machine that will lift them up one by one, a saw will come in, cut them in half, and then those two halves will be put into these dry cask storage containers. At that point, those dry casks will be moved into that long concrete row with all those holes right and put in there. There has been a lot of problems with the construction and the design of this facility. There was a contractor brought in to do it. It fell through. Now they're bringing in a Holtec here from the U.S. is the ones running that out there right now.
There was no time when after the disaster everyone just beefed out of there. These spent four pools of hot and
they
kept power on the whole time. To
yeah. That is one of the main primary differences between Chernobyl and Fukushima is there wasn't a loss of off-site power. So their auxiliary systems, the other reactors, they were fine. And really the worst effect that they had was the exposure of the operators during that accident. Obviously, now they did not leave. They did get a increased dose other than they would have on another day because of that accident, and it continued after that. But I think it's also important to note that in terms of decommissioning, these other reactor buildings were obviously affected by this disaster, and the decommissioning activities are going to be different because of this external contamination. It's going to be more costly. The building materials are going to require different methods of disposal. I think it's important to remember any nuclear power plant has the potential, if it reaches the wrong configuration, to turn itself into a permanent nuclear waste disposal facility. And we need to consider that when we're licensing, relicensing, or considering the environmental impacts, because to be honest, there are very few less attractive places for a long-term spent fuel repository than right next to the ocean and in the middle of a great forest and farming agricultural area.
Or so, near seismic faults.
Right.
I'm going to take a moderator prerogative here and ask where the people are, because we've been talking about stuff again. I want to ask you a question, if you would. There seems to be an impression here in the United States that, you know, the Japanese people are complacent, the, you know, nail that sticks up gets hammered down, that the Japanese don't react anymore. I'd like you to talk about the activism that took place both in the 50s and then also currently around Fukushima, if you would.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of shake do they get from the media over there?
Yeah.
Right. Thank you. The activism in the 50s was enormous, but this was not that long after the U.S. occupation of Japan. The reverse course, as it's called, of the U.S. occupation of Japan indicates that American priorities shifted in the course of the occupation, which lasted until 1952, only April of 1952. It changed its priorities from the democratization of Japan to securing Japan as a keystone for its geopolitical designs in that region of the world, which meant, in part, that some of the Class A war criminals, people who had been charged with those serious crimes for World War II, were released from prison, and some of them became prime minister subsequently. And in their place, in many greater numbers, were labor union organizers, ordinary people who participated in this anti-nuclear activism. So it was huge and therefore alarming, and some people paid considerably for it. Because clearly the United States was not interested in Japan encouraging this kind of behavior or this kind of opinion to develop. After the Fukushima disaster, there's a well-known philosopher who was asked by a cynical journalist, well, what's the point of demonstrating? What good do you think it's going to do? To which he said, it will show Japanese people that they can demonstrate. That's the good of demonstrating. And that was very sensible. It sounds circular, and it is, but it's very true. If lots of people are joining in, it makes it easier, right, for all of us. And that continued. There was a huge crushing of spirits with the first restart. Remember, Japan has gone for some years with most of its 54 reactors shut down. Only now, I think there are three running at the moment. It managed. There is some cost, of course, carbon fossil end, but it has managed, and that solar renewable sources are abounding. The government has to figure out how to do something about that. The demonstrations, it takes a lot of energy to demonstrate, right? You have to have the time. along with the will, and so they have tapered off. What people have done is they have, over three years, criminal complaints because the official system, the judicial system, the prosecutors show no willingness whatsoever to investigate with the possibility of indictment. Citizens had to launch what was called a complaint, and that in the first instance involved 1,400 some people, not just citizens of Japan, not just citizens, residents of Fukushima, but people who resided in Fukushima at the time, between the ages of 7 and 87, wrote their personal statements and presented them to the Fukushima District Prosecutor's Office, saying, this is what we have experienced. We cannot believe that no one is going to be held responsible for this. In Japan, this is a criminal procedure, that is to say, negligence, professional negligence leading to injury or death. The prosecutor sat on it for over a year, close to a year. And then the day before Prime Minister Abe returned from London to announce that he had secured the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, the case was summarily moved from Fukushima to Tokyo, lumped with other much less carefully prepared complaints, and dismissed. That's very important. The complainants had gone to Fukushima for two reasons. One is these people are very careful in trying to show their, not to make false enemies. They wanted to send a message to the Fukushima prosecutors that we know you're human beings like us, you work here, you too are worried about your young children living here. And when they go for an action, they will say, because the district prosecutor's office will send out the youngest of them to stand out in the dust and say, go back in, we're not going to cross any lines we're not supposed to. Take care of your own health. The care put into getting experts, whether legal or scientific, to think about themselves as vulnerable human beings, I think is a wonderful, inspiring, and important reminder of how we need to think about these people. That it was important because they felt the Fukushima prosecutors could be appealed to in a way different from Tokyo. True or not, I don't know. But an important principle, anyway. The second was that if you're an activist and you, or become an activist and you live in this devastated area, it costs a huge amount of money if you have to keep traveling to Tokyo for every action. So this was very strategically done by the government. The dismissal, what did they do? Then the complaint went to what's called a Citizens Inquest Committee, somewhat like our grand jury, only it's not presided over by a prosecutor. So 11 arbitrarily chosen citizens serving for 6 months, 8 have to agree on indictment, and indeed they did. So agreed on 3 executives, former executives of TEPCO. The case was sent back again to the prosecutors, who sat on it for some more months and found again, miraculously, that they saw no reason to indict. At which point it went to a new citizens' inquest, a new set of 11 citizens, who found again that there was reason to indict. At this point, it is clear to everyone, including the judicial system, the authorities, that the prosecutors have no intention to bring any charges. And so the court has appointed 5 attorneys to serve as prosecutors. This is unprecedented. There's never been such a large team. And this case will start, this criminal procedure will begin this summer. And there's a strong effort to support, to show the people sitting inside the courthouse that there is strong interest, public interest in this case. There are also groups coming together now, various kinds of, there are many, many, many civil cases ongoing, asking for compensation, asking for constitutional rights, like it says in the Constitution, you know, children should be guaranteed the right to be educated in safe places. There was a high court decision handed down now 3-4 years ago that said it's true these kids are going to school in an area with elevated levels that exceed what's acknowledged by the law, but but there's no point in moving them from this school, said the High Court, because they're going to go home to homes that are also in a contaminated area. So just leave them in these schools, in effect. So there are many, many procedures ongoing, and they have just this year, beginning last year, begun to band together and liaison. And there was a big gathering in early this month with one of the slogans being, "We are victims fighting back." It's a very hard thing to do anywhere. Very brave thing to do in Japan.
What about the media?
Off and on. They vary. The media are being increasingly clamped down. New state secret law. The difficulty about the state secret law is that you don't know what you're not supposed to tell. That is also kept secret, so the state has maximal flexibility to clamp down on you. So you begin to guess, oh, well, there's a nuclear restart policy. You're probably not supposed to write about opposition to nuclear restart, security treaty issues, because Japan wants to remilitarize officially. So nothing works like uncertainty, right, when you don't know where the attack can come from. So the official media, there's still some stalwart efforts and stalwart journalists. The internet, it has both its great and debilitating aspects, but the information that internet readers can get and that readers of the ordinary press get is hugely different.
When you showed us Elena, do you know what I mean by Elena? It was glowing, and I wondered if that was being illuminated.
Yeah, there's just no light in there, so it was probably a headlamp. They were using a flashlight. So it was an illumination.
Because you had to skip the 7 levels of subcontracting, if you could just quickly tell us what that was about.
This is what you're concerned about?
No, it's just...
Okay. Subcontracting. So TEPCO itself maintains a certain level of employee presence on the grounds. But after that, it subcontracts out to other people to do cleanup. It won't surprise you to learn that the work the TEPCO employees do is considered the less dangerous work on the grounds. And as the degrees of subcontract, so a subcontractor will will gather together workers to do this aspect of the mitigation. But then that may rely on, in gathering the manpower to do that, will rely on another firm to do this aspect of the work. And so it goes on. The last I knew it was about 7 levels. It may be more now. But what's happening is that TEPCO will claim complete ignorance about what's happening at the 5th or 6th level. Worker safety, well, it's up to the employee at that level. The other level is that fees are being charged at every step of the way, so that the people who are at the bottom of this chain of employment are getting paid much less than whatever the going rate might have been at the beginning.
I have something to add to that, too. There's a reason why you don't use your TEPCO engineers for these more menial tasks. Have you ever seen the diagrams for a nuclear power plant? You know, it's a very, very cluttered and very different type of design. But what you don't realize is that over the years of operation, they add new pipes, they might change something. The problems that they have after these disasters is that the plans aren't always exactly accurate. The people who know the most about the plant, who know where this switch is, where I need to go, or what needs to be done, are the people who have worked there. They have this institutional memory that they have accumulated over time at working on the site. They become infinitely more valuable after an accident because they're the ones that can reduce your stay times, who can direct workers maybe a different route to an area that you need to get. So you don't want to have them going out picking up radioactive materials, because that's something that anyone can do, whereas not just anyone knows the interiors or the electrical configuration or whatever that be. But when it comes to the funds being charged. There's a phrase in Ukraine that they like to use, and the translation in English is loosely, after cutting the fat, some sticks to the hands. And that's essentially how these contracting firms come. You know, everyone divides up the fat and the funds, and everyone ends up coming away with greasy hands afterwards.
Mm. Okay, because of time, I think we're going to have to end on that note. A couple of quick things, though. You handled the truth very well. I appreciate the two of you for expressing it. I'm really glad that your friend was able to share that advice with us. And I'm also glad that you brought up our late friend, Dr. Jeff Patterson. Mm-hmm. Telling the truth is not enough. Sometimes you have to fight the scum as well, the secrecy, the cover-up, and the minimization. And I wanted to mention that you will have an opportunity to do that in Chicago on March 29th. The Department of Energy is coming to town. They would like your opinion on what would it take for you to host radioactive waste facilities.